Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spark Radio Show, filled with strategies, possibilities, actions, resources, and knowledge that may be the spark of a better solution to ignite a positive change in your life. The number to call if you have questions for Melanie or any of our guests is area code 347-215-8390. Now, here's your host, Ms. Melanie.
Well, hello and welcome to or welcome back to Spark Radio. I am your host, Ms. Melanie, and as always, it is my pleasure to spend some time with you sharing those sparks. And I thank you for investing your time to join us tonight. I'm excited to welcome our guests, and we have so much to talk about. I will remind you that the challenge is to take action on something that you hear, that you learn, that might spark a change in your life. And tonight, we are going to talk about Sparks of the Fourth Awakening with Jeffrey A. Martin. And I want to introduce Jeffrey to you. He is a successful technologist, serial entrepreneur, scholar, author, and educator. His interests and work span many fields, including leadership and management, politics, psychology, computer science, spirituality and religion, electronic media, transformation, and consciousness. A personal crisis of faith at age 16 led to a 10-year search and immersion through every major and many minor religions and spiritual systems, as well as philosophical systems, looking for answers as he tried to rebuild a foundation for his life. When he didn't find any answers, he took a step back and asked what was most important. The answer he eventually came to was, quote, quality of life in this moment. Unquote, and he spent his life since that time researching how to best achieve and maximize it. Jeffrey wrote his first book, Volume 1, in the now legendary Complete Guide to Reiki series in 1993 during this quest. Jeffrey holds undergraduate degrees in liberal arts and applied computer studies and graduate degrees in management and information technology. A perpetual researcher and lifelong learner, he's currently a graduate student studying psychology at Harvard University and at California Institute of Integral Studies, where he studies transformation and transdisciplinarity. We'll talk more about that in our interview tonight. Jeffrey is a co-editor, author, co-author, or contributor to over 20 books, ranging from holistic health to information technology. He's written many scholarly and non-scholarly publications and has been featured in many forms of media. The Fourth Awakening is Jeffrey's first collaboration on a fiction book. He's also the executive editor of the Journal of Transformative Studies, the director of the Center for the Study of Intent, and he's on the advisory board of several other research organizations, such as the Center for the Study of Yoga and Health. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Melanie. It's great to be with you. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I'm excited to tell you that I have a question in the chat room already, I've got a caller on the line already, and we haven't started yet. Oh, wow, is right.
That's the way my inbox has been. We have just been absolutely pounded with emails from readers, and it's been great. We love hearing from them.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'll share the question quickly that's in the chat room. Says, do you possess the same abilities as the main character, Michael?
You know, fortunately, I haven't yet had to break out of the Charleston Naval Brig by turning invisible and bilocating or anything like that. So happy to report I haven't needed those yet, which is good because I don't have them.
Okay. And thank you for asking that question. So for those of you who are in the chat room, feel free to type your questions. We do have a few questions that we want to cover with Jeffrey. Do you want to go ahead and take the caller that's on the line right now before we get started?
Sure.
Okay. And this call is from area code 513. You're on the air with Jeffrey and Melanie. What's your question? Hello? Okay, they're shy, I guess. All right, well, I'll go ahead and close the microphone, and maybe they just decided they wanted to listen by phone tonight. I know I have someone else who had said they couldn't get to a computer. Could they call in? And I said, absolutely. Just let me know your number so I won't put you on the spot. And that's a different area code. So welcome, Jeffrey. I'm excited to talk with you. been looking forward to this, and I know my regular listeners are as well.
Thank you.
So if you're ready, let's go.
Absolutely.
Right. Some general things we want to start with about some pieces that are information that are behind the book before we get into some things about the book itself. And in my research, I learned that the book is grounded in your research. Can you tell us a little bit more about the research that led to the Fourth Awakening?
Absolutely. I mean, the book really exists because of that research. What happened was, a few years ago, I decided that I wanted to learn a very advanced form of academic scholarship, really sort of a cutting-edge type of academic scholarship called transdisciplinarity. And the idea behind that is that ordinarily, scholars and academia live their life in these little tiny silos. So you might study one tiny part of one tiny part of one tiny part of psychology, for instance, and you really never go outside of those bounds in your entire career. And what's happened from an academic standpoint over the years is that, especially in recent years, people have started to say, we've got all this knowledge that is just locked up in these little tiny silos and nobody's talking to each other. How can we get some real leverage and take ideas across different parts of the same discipline or across different types of disciplines, maybe from psychology and sociology and anthropology, biology, and just sort of combine them and roll them all into one and really see what, you know, magic is there to come out of all of the research. So transdisciplinarity is pretty new, and it comes from that idea. That's difficult in the academic world. One of the things that most people don't realize about being in sort of a university system is that it's a very competitive and it's kind of a brutal environment. And even within the same discipline, like psychology, you might have social psychology that looks at groups of people and individual personality psychology looks at just an individual. And they might consider themselves not very valid. You know, they might be using very different techniques and they'll argue about whether the other person's techniques are valid. So it's a very hard thing to sort of get different people trained in different disciplines to agree on how to do research that combines across different sections of the same field, much less across different fields. So I decided that that was really a cool idea, that there was probably a lot there that could benefit people. And I decided to study it. And I originally thought I was going to have to go to Europe to do it, but I wound up at the very last minute finding a program out in California at the California Institute of Integral Studies, which has a largely overseas faculty, actually, for that program. And a lot of connections into the people in Europe that have really sort of originated this type of idea. But in order to get into the program, I had to focus on a specific topic. I had to come to them with a problem to work on. And they didn't make me do a dissertation on it, but I just had to use it in classes so that they could teach me how to think along the lines of what's acceptable for this type of scholarship. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I wound up choosing mind-matter interaction. You know, I'd always wondered if there was anything really to the idea that our thoughts can produce any sort of imprint or impression or change in reality. And I knew that it would be across a huge range of academic departments, that it would involve, you know, physics and biology, computer science would be folded into it, medicine, obviously, because of things like the placebo effect, psychology and parapsychology, and, you know, it met their requirements, probably on a scale, you know, far beyond what even I would say my fellow students in the program had picked a topic. Theirs were much more narrow than that, but I really was curious about it. I really wanted to find out if there was anything to it. And one great advantage of going with California Institute of Integral Studies instead of going to Europe for this is that a couple of the leading thinkers on mind-matter interaction, which is called synchronicity most often in the academic literature, were at the school. And so my primary advisor was one of the top people associated with it, and I was able to have classes with and help out with classes, and another guy who was one of the top physicists of Canada now lives overseas in Italy, and did most of his teaching remotely. So that's basically how I started down this research track. And I next traveled around, really, to lots of academic conferences and really just tried to actually meet everyone I possibly could in person that had worked on this in any way. There's a tremendous advantage, of course, to having a personal relationship with somebody, to being able to really sit across from them during dinner and ask them in-depth questions for an hour or two. And so that traveling around and meeting all of sort of the people who had done any serious research in it gave me a fantastic grounding and a fantastic survey of what was out there. And it also, you know, when you're talking to someone, you can get a gist of whether or not you really believe in the research that they've done or whether you think that they're just, you know, cutting some corners and maybe that's not something to pay a lot of attention to. And then the next thing that I did was I just started reading, and I read across, you know, thousands of studies across the different disciplines that I mentioned, as well as many more. And that was difficult, and that was tricky, because I'm not a doctor, so I had to rely on help from other people to interpret some of the medical studies, as an example. I'm not a quantum physicist, so I had to rely on people like David Peet, who was the professor that I mentioned that's in Italy and one of the world's top physicists, for an understanding to make sure that I was really grasping what I was reading in those studies. But I had a great team around me. I had a lot of people helping me out in different disciplines, and you know, they were as curious about the answers as I was, and they were thrilled that somebody was willing to take some time, a period of years out of their life, and really dive in and see if there was an answer there. So over time, gradually, a picture started to emerge. And from that, I actually wound up developing a model that goes from sort of least effective to most effective. Most of the stuff in the studies showed what didn't work. And so what I was really doing was ruling things out much more than ruling things in. It's not like I had thousands of studies that showed me what worked. What I had were thousands of studies that showed what didn't work, and only a very small handful of hints to collect together what did work.
Wow. So if I asked you to tell me the most important piece of advice that you would share from your research to date, what might that be?
The most important piece of advice, I think, you know, really it has to be, if I'm meeting someone on the street and I could just, and they're into this type of thing and they're saying, you know, I'm into mind matter stuff. I've seen The Secret, all the Law of Attraction stuff. I've seen What the Bleep. I've seen all of this mass market type of stuff. Maybe they've been into some of the New Thought publications. I would first of all, I would have to warn them. I would have to tell them that, you know, my research wasn't entirely based in studies and talking to people. I also, once I had that grounding, I started experimenting with it. I started putting together groups of people and running experiments. And what I discovered from those experiments was that there was a lot of danger and a lot of trouble that could result from just sort of randomly using these different ideas that are floating around out there. And in fact, I had a lot of disastrous results in people's lives when I first started to play with these in my research groups. So what I learned over time is that people really have to use the method that's right for them. Now, if they're using the method that's right for them, and it's a decent method, it'll work, and they should see those results right away. But if not, at best, it will be spotty. But at worst, it can really, really produce bad results in people's lives. I mean, you can, in a sense, mess around with reality a little bit. And it's a very complex system to go playing around with. So I had, you know, bankruptcies come out of nowhere among research participants, difficulties with, you know, marriages, you know, falling apart. I mean, just all sorts of things like that. That's really the first thing that I would give to someone is, hey, listen, this is not trivial stuff just because it's out there and it sounds like it's all this positive, you can't go wrong with it type thing. That's really not the case when you actually start looking at it and you actually start applying some scientific method and some experimentation to it. So that's what I would, if I just could tell people one thing, that's what I'd tell them. But that's not really the most important thing that I learned over the course of my research.
then you know I'm going to ask you, what would you say is the most important thing that you learned?
Yeah, I baited you a little with that one.
You did.
Well, it really is unbelievable in its importance for people to grasp that they're into those types of ideas, and that is the role of release. Nothing turns out to be more important than the role of release. And it took me over a year to even get sort of a functional, able to experiment with it definition of release itself. Release, I mean, if you say to someone, if you're reading, for instance, something like, some law of attraction type book, and it says, well, at the minimum, it'll say express some intent, wish for what you want. It may say to do that with visualization. It may say to do that by putting positive affirmations around, whatever it does. Basically, it says express some intent. And the second thing that it's going to tell you, maybe, not all of them, but maybe, is to imbue that with some sort of emotion. Usually it says to imbue it with positive emotions. It may also say to, really feel the way you would feel while you're doing the visualization, feel the way you would feel if that had come true, that type of thing. And then a very tiny proportion of these types of materials say something like, and then when you're done, just completely let go of it, just totally put it out of your mind and don't think about it anymore and just wait for it to show up and know that it's on its way. And well, the first two are pretty cut and dry. I mean, those are pretty easy to see how you do those. That last one, if you have something that if you're starving and you really need the $10 to get, gas to go to get some food, it's really kind of hard to think about how you can release around notions that are very important to you. And ordinarily, if you're taking the time out of your life to express intent, to generate the emotion, it's going to be important stuff to you. And you can do that first part, all you want, and you're going to have, pretty spotty results. But when you start bringing in the idea of release and you start really sort of understanding the different layers of release and how deep that release can go, and in fact, I eventually realized that what I was calling release was actually two separate things. It was release and surrender, and that there was a distinction between just releasing and going beyond that, even that notion of release, into sort of a concept of surrendering. That's really when I started to get a hint that of what actually made or could make this type of idea work. Now, there's different types of release, and we can talk about that a little bit later if you'd like. But just as an example, if one thing that people often do with that are into sort of the law of attraction type ideas or the new thought type ideas is that some people will run across material that will say immerse yourself in what you want, put pictures of it up all over the place, just try to constantly stay tuned into it. And there's a type of release, actually, that seems to come from that. It's a very unreliable form of release, and it's sort of what makes that idea, the whole concept, unreliable in and of itself. But that is, you can sort of get to the point where those things are around you so much that you do sort of just start ignoring them. And at that point, you are, largely releasing from it. And things have a much greater chance of happening when that's the case. So release can go from that type of concept, and it can go all the way up really to the most effectual forms of release, and the people who can really just produce astonishing results when you're working with them, like I do from a research standpoint, are people who are in what I call non-symbolic consciousness, which is, of course, part of the book. Part of what the book focuses on is introducing that concept of non-symbolic consciousness. To me, they are on the far end of the continuum. And in fact, what I've just described is kind of bookends. You can sort of put new thought all the way on the left side of a continuum, and you can put people who are in those very advanced non-symbolic states on the far right side of the continuum. And largely going from left to right, you have more, you're going from less effective to more effective with these types of ideas. The irony, of course, is that once someone hits those far reaches, when I talk to my research subjects that are in those far reaches of non-symbolic consciousness, although they can seemingly produce just amazing synchronicities, they don't care at all about it. They have absolutely no desire to. They view the world as perfect. They have no desire to really change it in any way. So it's kind of an irony there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that concept is mentioned in the book, too, that, as you said, with non-symbolic consciousness. How would you define non-symbolic consciousness to people who haven't heard that term before?
That is a very good question. I get that question a lot in email. Non-symbolic consciousness is a catch-all term that I use for these types of what have traditionally been regarded as sort of advanced spiritual states. So each tradition has its own label for them. If you're a Christian, you would know them as mystical states of consciousness. If you were a Zen practitioner, you might call them non-dual states of consciousness. You know, someone else might call them enlightenment. And enlightenment states of consciousness. So it's these types of labels and concepts that most people are at least have some cursory familiarity with. But there's a debate that goes on in the sort of scholarly community around this. And this is actually a big part of my work and a big part of what I'm trying to do on the academic side of the fence is get these so that they're considered a legitimate area of study, because traditionally they really haven't been considered a valid area of study. They've sort of been considered even a pathology of sorts, a strong disassociation that people have. The sort of the psychological community has viewed them as something to either ignore or get rid of, but not really taken them seriously, not really looked into them in any sort of deep or meaningful way. And so you find the philosophy community, wrestling with them a lot, and you find the religious community wrestling with them a lot, but in very abstract ways, not in any way that they've actually tried to pull them into a lab and measure. And those other communities, the way that they've looked at these states, there's two different thoughts on them. The first is that if you have a Zen non-dual practitioner and you have a Christian mystic, what they're actually experiencing doesn't have anything to do with the same underlying core. Their descriptions of the state are very, very similar, but of course different, because they're viewing them through their ideology. And so you wind up with one group of people inside the academic world saying, these are different things. These aren't the same things. And then you wind up with another group, which is, I think, really the largest group, and certainly the group that I count myself in, which says, no, these seem to be people trying to describe a very similar, basically the same deep underlying experience. And they're just using their own cultural descriptions. They're just using their own life experiences, their own ideologies, their own whatever, their own basically their own selves and what they've constructed as themselves. And their ability to language out and describe things. And, of course, that's going to be different if you're living in, a temple in Nepal versus, the suburbs of Philadelphia. You're going to have just different cultural ways of expressing that. So that's called the Common Core Thesis. And I really think that what we're talking about is the same thing, and I'm an adherent sort of to that Common Core Thesis. And so what I think is that really you have people who are describing these states, and they feel a profound sense of unity with everything. Just as an example, very often there's positive emotions that go along with it. Joy and love and peace are often the three that are most described. And the way they describe them is that these are not separate, distinct emotions that are being felt, but rather there's some sort of very intense combination of those three emotions that is what being felt. That's what's being felt within them. They feel a tremendous certainty. They feel, they say that, who they were before they had that come upon them permanently is sort of their little self that went away and it was never a real self. And it's the self that you and I are talking with right now and that you and I'm making a presumption about you, of course, but most callers, most people that would be out there listening, are living in, from a day-to-day moment, and their experience is just very different. It's a radical alternation. Then they are extraordinarily happy, content, fulfilled individuals, which is what makes them very interesting to me as a population to research. because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I've looked around an awful lot, and I haven't found any group of people that is this genuinely peaceful and just deeply happy and joyous. So if you're going to spend time trying to figure out something to try to spread in the world, that seems like a pretty good thing to try to get out there, you know.
It sure does. And as people are listening to you describe this state of non-symbolic consciousness, is there any way, if they were interested in being involved in your research, that they could do that?
Absolutely. And thank you for bringing that up, because I certainly meant to do that. If people think that they are in that state of consciousness, and if it's come upon them, I don't know anyone that it's come upon that hasn't gone out and looked up and tried to figure out what was happening to them if they didn't realize it ahead of time. And there are people that happens to. Some people, they really pursue it. You know, they might do transcendental meditation for 20-some years before it settles into them permanently, and they know what's coming. You know, they've had experiences along the way. They've done a lot of study. They've got a lot of thoughts around it. But other people, it just, boom, it just happens to it. Just the switch just flips in them. And they go out and they try to figure out what's happening to them. You know, obviously, first they usually, you know, go and sit on a bench or something for a couple of years. But eventually, they all sort of, you know, come back and wonder, you know, what is this and what's going on. And so, if any of your listeners have had that, and if they've had it, they've probably, you know, either they know they're experiencing something and they think it might be it right now, or they've gone and looked it up, or it's been something that they've been pursuing for a while. Absolutely. What I'm really trying to do is build a very large and there's not a lot of these people, so building a very large research pool is not easy. I'm trying to build a very large research pool of people that can be accessed by other scholars, so that we can really begin to move this into scientific research, maybe find some ways to make it a much, much more consistent and reliable experience. Because right now, there really isn't anything that I can recommend to someone that I can say, you know what, you go do this for a month and you'll get there. All the techniques that are very, very unreliable, if someone has one, absolutely contact me. I'd love to know about it. But I've looked through more than you can possibly imagine at this point. And they're very unreliable. But what's interesting about them is that at the time most of them were developed, they were the cutting edge of science. So, for instance, there's some of these products I really like, and I'll maybe put in a little plug for him here, but probably some of your listeners will have been familiar with him. And his name is Jeffrey Thompson. He runs this. He runs a lab out in San Diego called Neuroacoustic Research. And he deals with using sound to alter consciousness and to also to heal people. And in a variety of very advanced ways. And he's one of the most capable, I would say, acoustical engineers and physicist type people that I've ever run across. And I spent, my early years were spent doing a lot of audio engineering for, you know, major networks like NBC and things like that. So I've got a pretty good immersion and a pretty good understanding of the types of things that he's working with. But he's just gone so far beyond, I think, what anyone else has. And so, you know, one of the things that you find. So I was talking to him one time, and he had some of the little Tibetan symbols, you know, that you cling together often that people mm-hmm. will start like a meeting with, and somebody clinked them together, and he kind of chuckled. And it turns out that he'd actually measured the frequencies of those at one point, because he noticed a long time ago, several years ago, when he first ran across those and they were clinked together, that they seemed to produce something that he had spent a number of years trying to replicate with modern equipment. And so, you know, it turns out that here you had hundreds, even 1,000 years ago, this technology that had been invented by somebody meditating somewhere in India or, you know, Tibet or Asia or who knows where, that had come up with this device that was designed to induce a certain state of consciousness, and so that he could share that with his fellow spiritual adherents, presumably. And this thing had been passed down, and now we use it to open meetings, and we've sort of, you know, forgotten how to use the thing. And Jeffrey had to reinvent this, you know, for us using computers and, you know, lots of advanced math. You find things like this all the time where they had these techniques and they had these technologies that were used, but we haven't brought them into science. We haven't brought them into our research capabilities. So for the last 150 years or so since the introduction of the German research model and the switching over of universities from religious institutions to research institutions, nobody's really looked into this. Nobody's really tried to say, you know, what can we do with neurofeedback to produce this? Instead of having to run a mantra through your head for 20 years, is it possible to just take a real good shortcut using some type of advanced neurofeedback technology or using some sort of magnetic field or microwave field? What I'm really trying to do is get it to the point where this becomes a legitimate line of research so that those types of pursuits can happen that will maybe make this a very routine thing for people to experience in later years. So absolutely, if anyone has the state, to get back to your question, Sarah, if anyone has the state of consciousness that I'm talking about and they would be willing to participate, we would love to have you. And you can contact me through the fourthawakening.com website. And I'll hook you up and bring you in right away. And I look forward to meeting you.
Awesome. Well, let's transition from the world of academia, which is where a lot of your work is. You're a recognized scholar and author in both academic and professional arenas. This is your first venture into the work of fiction. What inspired you to co-author The Fourth
That's
Awakening?
That's a really good question. I can't believe that I have a fiction book out after having done so much nonfiction. And in all fairness, there's absolutely no way that I could have written a fiction book. So let me give you a little bit of the background of how that happened. I was really, if you can imagine, if you're doing research and you're realizing that what people are out there using every day has a greater likelihood of producing a disaster in their life than a positive effect, you start to feel a little moral pressure in how to start spreading the word about that. And that was exactly what was happening to me, is that I was really trying to think through, you've got this enormous amount of information out there that's pointing people towards experimenting with those methods in their personal lives. And I was trying to think, you know, how can I break through that noise? How can I break through that clutter? Well, I was researching the history of the New Thought movement. One of the things that you do when you're doing academic research is you go back as far as you can, and you try to start at the very beginning, and you try to understand where things came from and what the perspectives were a long time ago. And there was this fantastic historian from Princeton University who had done her thesis, her PhD dissertation there. She was a period scholar. She had no dog in the fight, you know, whatsoever. There's a lot of stuff that's been written on the New Thought movement from religious scholars and stuff like that. But you know, they all have their own religious lenses that they're viewing this through. She was a period scholar, and somehow she just threw a dart at a board and decided to research women and gender and the New Thought movement at the time when the New Thought movement was just brand new and emerging. And so she came with this really clear view. Her name, if your listeners want to look her up, is Beryl Sater.
Can you spell that?
I want to say it's S-A-T-E-R. I'm not sure. I don't know that I can quite remember how to spell Beryl. That's kind of an unusual one.
Mm-hmm. If they went just, you know, looked up women, gender, and the New Thought movement, they'd probably find it.
Probably. I think I am online. Let me see if I can just quickly verify this for you here.
Oh, technology is wonderful.
It is. Get my other hand here. Wanted to see the chat questions as they were coming in, you know.
We have 11 people in the chat room, so if you have questions for Jeffrey, either about his research or about the book, The Fourth Awakening, go ahead and type them in. And callers, thank you very much for holding on, because we're going to get into your questions in probably the next 5 to 7 minutes. So thanks for hanging in there.
So the book is called Each Mind a Kingdom, American Women's Sexual Purity and the New Thought Movement from 1875 to 1920, but Each Mind a Kingdom is all you really need. And her name is spelled BerylSattER. And the book is actually just her PhD dissertation adapted with some of, like, you know, the zillions of references and stuff stripped out of it, adapted more for a public audience. So, when I read the book and when I read her PhD dissertation, they were largely the same. So if you go back, you find a couple of very interesting things. First of all, and of course, in today's New Thought movement and the Law of Attraction type thing is, and The Secret and all of that, there's a lot of pointing back to these early books. Well, the first thing that you realize is that you cannot possibly understand what's written in those books, reading them for the modern eyes. That they were all wrapped up in the gender politics of the time and just all sorts of movements. And, you know, if you read Sater and then you go back and read those books, there you get it. Because she can really put you there. But just going back as an individual and trying to read some of the books from that early period that are so often referenced, you realize just how far off the modern interpretations of those are to begin with. The other thing that is amazing when you go back and you read her work is just how, you know, you also can't point to those authors as having been people who ever got those types of ideas to work for them. I mean, these poor people had just really messed up lives and terrible political situations that they were dealing with, and they were really, I mean, it's sort of interesting how we both misunderstand and also sort of romanticize those early texts and think that there's this body of people who just figured it out and had sort of this golden age for themselves, when if you actually look back at their writings like she did and pull up all their old newsletters and all their old magazines and their correspondence and just all kinds of stuff, it paints a very different picture. So I went back and I was researching the history of the New Thought Movement, and one of the things that there was out of the University of, I want to say, Pennsylvania, there was somebody who did a dissertation on how the New Thought Movement was fueled by advances in communication, how at a certain time it became easy to publish small booklets, and then there was a huge boom, and at other times there were just sort of these different communication mechanisms that came online. I mean, in our current times, right, we would say that would be the Internet. That would be exploding out. So you just have these little technological blips, and every time there's a little technological blip, these ideas make it out there even wider and wider and wider. Well, as I looked back through the history of both Sater and this other person who had looked at sort of just the communication structure of it all, what I wound up noticing was that there were always books that seemed bigger and seemed to touch people much more than the nonfiction books. And those were fiction books. That every one of these epochs had a fiction book that had really sort of reached out to people in a ways that all of the other courses, and, you know, there were a lot of through the mail courses and magazines and all sort of the nonfiction books, of course, but all sort of the nonfiction materials reached a much smaller percentage compared to the fiction things. And so I've been thinking about that for a little while, and Rod came up to visit me in Cincinnati, which is where he lived for a long time and where we first met. And we were sitting on my deck, and he is a phenomenally gifted fiction writer. He'd put his daughter, you know, he'd wanted to stay home with his daughters while he was raising them, and so during that period of time, all he did was basically crank out novels and screenplays, you know, TV shows and things like that. And he's just, you know, so incredibly gifted at it that he was able to do something that's not very easy to do, frankly, which is actually support yourself decently and get your kids, you know, through grade school, through high school, even through, you know, out-of-state colleges, as he often likes to joke. You know, so he does a lot of writing. He does just a huge amount of writing. Very little of it is under his name. But during that period, he did do some books under his name. So anyway, I knew this about him, and I knew that he was just a phenomenal fiction writer, and we'd been very good friends for many years at that point, probably about 10 years. And we'd also been business partners on quite a few ventures, so we had a very close relationship. And I just put this idea out to him. We'd never talked about these topics before. I thought, frankly, that it would be the last thing in the world that he would ever be interested in. You know, my perception of him was someone that I worked in the technology side of things with. I worked, we do some stuff in politics together. I've used him writing political stuff. I mean, I knew a very conservative version of him that I thought could never possibly be interested in these types of ideas. But nonetheless, I put it out there, and we started talking about it. And really, you know, it went from there. So I have to say that the fiction and the story and everything, that's really his genius. The fact that it's this amazing page-turner that, you know, everybody's given to their friends, and we get all these emails all the time from people who say that they can't go to bed, they wind up reading it all night, and, you know, hopefully none of those people are like neurosurgeons or something. But, you know, I mean, it's just this constant flood of communications from people saying that, and that is really all him. I mean, he is just such a phenomenally gifted fiction writer. So that's where the idea of this fiction book came from. I could have never done it on my own. It's not the type of writing that I do. And so he wrote the way he was used to writing. It's kind of a funny collaborative process. He wrote the way he was used to writing, and he sent me the first draft. And he would always like lock himself away, complete a book, and then put it out to the world, and then sort of start working on the next one. He wasn't used to getting feedback, you know, and so we had some real sort of, you know, knockdown, drag out exchanges. And the book wound up being really just an amazing collaboration. I can't believe, I really feel like we were just such a tool for the universe at large. You know, when I look at this amalgam of his talents that came together with what I brought to the project, it just, I mean, it's this piece of magic that just came out of it. It's phenomenal.
Oh, wonderful. And we're going to jump into questions. Before we do that, I do want to read the teaser for The Fourth Awakening in case there are people who are on the call or in the chat room who have not looked at the book, which we're going to talk further if we have time about some of those concepts. And this is the teaser that is out on the website, and it's also in various places, that says, "Your life will change forever." The story is about a group of scientists led by a legendary Nobel Prize-winning physicist has made a discovery so startling and with such deep religious implications that it sends shockwaves through the corridors of power around the world. As the federal government moves to suppress the research, all of those involved vanish without a trace. A mysterious call from the editor of the Washington Post starts Penelope Drayton Spence off in search of the missing scientists. After she crosses paths with enigmatic industrialist Michael Walker, Penelope becomes a fugitive in a wild, hold-on-tight-to-the-edge-of-your-seat race to expose the truth about the Hermes Project before the government can cover it up. While a work of fiction, The Fourth Awakening is grounded in cutting-edge science and emerging spiritual reality. It offers readers a glimpse of our shared future. So we're going to stop with that, and we'll take questions because we've got about 16 minutes remaining. So while you're answering questions, I'm going to see, do you have time, Jeffrey, to stay on a little longer tonight?
Sure.
If we can make that work, I'll give it my best shot. In the meantime, I'm going to open up the microphone. So the caller from area code 320, what question or comment do you have for Jeffrey? Okay. Someone else?
Yeah, I'm scaring them all away.
I must just be listening. Or it wasn't either that, yes, or they're just on the line because they couldn't be at a computer. So I'll go ahead
gotcha.
And close the mic. And let's go over to the chat room. And you said you had the chat room open on your computer, Jeffrey?
Yeah, let me get back to that. I have barrels stuck up in here.
Oh, yes, because you were jumping and doing some research. Let's back up to the question that says, Jeffrey, have you ever known anyone personally who had the experience of bilocation or moved through an object like Penelope's window, and they did it inexplicably?
Yes. I've known many people who reported that they had that experience to me. One of them, let me think if there's anyone that I can actually say, you can go look this person up. There's a book that I really like. It's difficult to find. but it's called The Power of Thought by a guy named Eugene Mowry. And in there, he really had quite an amazing life. And he's one of the people that applied sort of power of thought type, law of attraction type things to building really a conglomerate business, a very large business in Chicago. And there was a story in there about a car that was coming up on a jackknifed truck of some kind, and the person just basically closed their eyes and just gave up and just, you know, totally let go, realized that it was hopeless. And then they came to, opened their eyes after they didn't feel, you know, their death, right? And they were basically sitting with their car stopped in a parking lot some ways down the road. So that's an example of some of the types of experiences that that relate. Those are probably the most common types of experiences that I hear. And if memory serves, I was having dinner at a conference called the USPA, where it's sort of an interesting mix of academics and non-academics. And I was sitting with a guy named Harold McCoy, who's an ex-military intelligence guy who started an organization down in Arkansas, sort of by where Walmart's out of. And it just so happened that we were sort of assigned to have dinner at the same table. And I happened to mention Mowry's book, and he's like, oh, he was an old friend of mine. And you know, that story was about him. So Mowry had abstracted it. And so, you know, I said, you know, well, what did you feel? And so I was able to, you know, dig into a little bit more. So that's one sort of common type of story that I'll hear surrounding that. Another interesting one, I was at an organization I like called the Monroe Institute, which does a lot of interesting research with sound and states of consciousness. And I was down there for a couple of weeks, a couple of years ago. And one of our trainers talked about how she had literally woken up in someone else's body out in California and had to sort of find her way back to her own body. And so you know, sometimes this experience of sort of bilocation or moving through things, it isn't always necessarily an experience like Harold related. There are other forms of it. There are other sort of unusual examples associated. So I've had to work a lot of that into trying to figure out if I can piece that together into a model of consciousness. And it's the anomalies like that I like to collect, because ultimately, if you can't explain the anomalies with a model, you know, what good is your model?
Mm-hmm. Well, then, and connected to that story about if you really know anyone that has done that, if you scroll down in the chat room, then you'll see the related question is, then if you know people that have accomplished such things, do you find it tends to align with people experiencing non-symbolic consciousness?
Well, and that's what I've really tried to figure out. So, for instance, there's an organization that just closed a couple of years ago that was at Princeton called the Pear Lab. And this was run by pretty serious people, I mean, very serious researchers with physicists, sort of material scientists, organist type inclinations. And in the end, sort of their final report had to say, you know, we're not really sure that we've proved, they're used a lot as having proved mind-matter interaction. You know, they're the first people that you come to. When someone's trying to convince you that science has proved that mind-matter interaction is real, that's who they point to, are these guys. And so I was having dinner there, Bob, John, and Brenda Dunn, who ran that project, and I was having dinner with Bob and Brenda. And I was, you know, just really wanting to sort of dig in for their interpretations. And they really sort of, at the end, if you read sort of their last report, they kind of say, well, we did one replication of this outside our lab. That failed. That's a very bad thing in science. We like things to be replicatable. You know, we can't really say that things have been proven to any degree of reliability until they've been replicated in lots of different ways, eliminating lots of different variables. And so we were talking, you know, sort of more and more about that. And one of the things that came out in that conversation that was an early piece of the puzzle for me on release was that it was Brenda really felt that people had, and I don't think they really wrote this anywhere that I know of, but Brenda really felt that people who felt, who reported feeling at one with the experimental apparatus were the ones who had the most success in basically affecting, their experiment dealt with affecting things at a quantum level, and they had sort of a way to detect that at a quantum level. And so they were basically able to affect reality at this very, very, you know, very micro level. And those were sort of the people that she felt really over the years had been the most successful at doing that. And as I've run into other labs and as I've run into other experimenters, I've always kept that in the top of my head, and I've always asked that. And it's been one of those sort of consistent things that have come back to me. And so from that, I started to, that was really an early thing that led me to the idea of non-symbolic consciousness, is that sort of oneness experience with the apparatus is very temporary for most of the people that are experiencing it. But, of course, it's very similar to that idea of feeling at one with everything that people report when they're in permanent non-symbolic consciousness. So it didn't take a rocket scientist to put those two together and start wondering if there was a relationship. And that was really an early key that pointed me in the right direction, I think.
Good. Well, let's go to a caller from area code 312. You're on the air with Jeffrey. What question or comment do you have tonight?
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you for taking the time to come out and speak and answer our questions. You mentioned the neuroacoustic research.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, I mean, a couple of things. Is that actually the name of it?
Yeah, Neuroacoustic Research Center, I think is the name of the center out in San Diego. Jeffrey Thompson, if you search for Jeffrey Thompson.
Thompson, thank you. And, I mean, because I've done some dabbling in the Centerpoint Research Institute with Bill Harris, and I've done the first couple of levels of his program. Any kind of thoughts on that? I mean, is there a really, really big difference between a lot of these programs? And if so, I mean, what do you find is really stands out as a difference?
Yes, I think there really is.
Okay.
For starters, you have to look at, I think, the level of research that goes into something, right? So, for instance, if the Monroe deals with the same type of technology, it all comes from an article many years ago from a guy named Gerald Osher. And so people have been experimenting with it since his first academic article many years ago, and you're talking about the very early 70s. And Monroe picked up on it very early on. They did, you know, they have just file cabinet after file cabinet after file cabinet of old EEG data, and of course a lot of it's computerized now in their recent experiments. And so they have just a massive working lab. Jeffrey Thompson has a very, you know, very sophisticated working lab set up. And so I think the first thing to ask yourself is who's actually looking at the brain to see the effects of this, as opposed to just trying to sort of feel them out phenomenologically. Thank you to the person who just posted that. The neuroacoustic.com is Jeffrey's site.
Perfect.
So there's another distinction, even though, between, just to give you an example, between like the competing lab ideas, and I love Monroe and I love Jeffrey. I think both of their research has done just some really amazing things. Jeffrey, if you talk to him and you say, what do you think of Monroe? Aren't you doing the same thing as Monroe, or aren't you doing the same thing as Bill Harris or whoever, or any one of the millions of Bill Harris knockoffs that are out there now, right? Well, what Jeffrey says is, my research showed me, and he has a medical background. He's the only one of these folks that has a medical background, so he comes at this from a medical standpoint. He said what his research showed him basically was that the types of tones, and they're basically square waves that are used in Centerpoint and that are used in Monroe's research and their programs and stuff, those types of things he really felt was putting a stress on the nervous system. And he spent many years trying to figure out how to eliminate that artifact, how to get the states of consciousness, how to get specific brain responses but at the same time not having to do it by producing what he saw as stress on the nervous system. And so he does it with, he doesn't use square waves like everybody else does. He uses, he basically uses, you know, dirty frequencies. He's got harmonics in there. Because he has an extremely sophisticated approach to it compared to everyone else. So I would say, yes, there are absolutely, you know, differences when you dive into this technology, and there are very different opinions. And there are very different, you know, research objectives. I mean, Monroe is not interested in the same thing that Thompson is into, you know. And so there's sort of differences from that as well. You know, Monroe started trying to replicate the out-of-body experiences that he was having when he lived in a house that had sort of this copper roof on it, this copper pyramid roof, and he started having out-of-body experiences. He was a radio engineer, radio pioneer of sorts, and manager and engineer. And so he basically, you know, he knew sound. He started playing with sound to alter consciousness. He tried to get people to experience what he was experiencing. And that's been the track, basically, that Monroe has followed ever since then. Jeffrey Thompson, he's much more into healing. He's very much into altered states of consciousness. Don't get me wrong, but, you know, he comes from a medical background. I mean, he wants people to get better. He wants to figure out how to use sound to heal. So he's even interested in, for instance, using sound to see if he can produce, you know, very sophisticated molecular responses inside the human body and things like that. I mean, you know, Monroe and Centerpoint, I mean, you know, other people are never going to be thinking along those lines. In terms of these types of technologies. And so, yeah, there are significant differences between technologies. There are really sort of come from the individuals that are behind the different outfits.
Great.
Is that
great?
That,
thank you.
Okay, sure.
Definitely.
Melanie, are you there?
Oh, yeah, I had muted myself while I was clicking away over here.
I've done that myself on calls. I know how that goes. So easy.
Oh,
to
yeah.
It.
So thanks for calling me back. I was able to add 30 minutes to our program so we can cover more questions. And so thank you, Jeffrey, for being able to stay with us to do that, because there are still some amazing points that we'd like to address and be able to answer questions that people have. So let's go to, well, we'll give a try, to area code 303. You're on the air with Jeffrey. What question do you have tonight?
Well, I actually have a question and a comment or whatever, but my first question is, how much of the book is really fiction-based, and how much is based on your research? Because I was intrigued when I read, and I know it's funny in the book, but about the whole Leary theory in the late 60s and all that perspective. And so I was just curious how you went there. And then my comment was, or question, I guess it is a question, but my other question was if you were familiar with Jill Bolte Taylor and her experience, and if you had anything to comment on that.
Absolutely. So let me take your first question and make sure I don't forget about your second question if I go for a while on your first question.
Okay.
So the first question is, how much of it is fictionalized? When we originally did the pass through the early manuscript versions of it, I had put in a lot of footnotes, and the original intent was to actually have a second section of the book that basically showed where the different pieces of the fiction came from, and the pretty much, you know, the stories sort of behind them. And in the end, that had to be cut because of page count considerations, and, you know, sort of publishing is what it is. And so those were snipped away. And now I'm trying to think about how I can maybe put those out in some sort of form and make them available to people. I'm going to have to wait until after. I'm in the middle of a summer semester at Harvard, which is, you know, a six-month semester compressed down to 6 weeks. And Harvard is already not the easiest place in the world to go to school. So it's a pretty intense six-week period that I'm in the middle of, and I'm probably going to need some recovery from it for at least a week or two, you know, on the other side of it. But I'm trying to figure out, you know, how can I really put that together and bring that out. So when you different pieces of it. I drove Rod crazy by holding his feet to the fire and rewriting things. And he was constantly lecturing me on how to write fiction and how I didn't understand at all what he was trying to do and how this was an important device to leave in to set up the story 3 books from now or something like that. And so that was a lot of what our early sort of battles back and forth were about. So when it comes to things like, for instance, and I'm sure probably we'll get to this at some point in the next half hour, like the evolution of consciousness literature, I will bet you we battled over that for 6 or 7 months before fine. And it was just, you know, there were things like that that I just felt like I could not give in on. But that represented a very important core message of the book. It had to be accurate to the literature that was out there from an academic research perspective. And then there were other things like the Timothy Leary piece that Rod basically took and ran with, and that I looked at and said, yeah, you know, I'm okay with that. I mean, there's no research on that, but I can't disprove it. It fits in with the storyline. It fits in with everything else. There's no research that I could really cite against what you're saying there, so why not, you know? Why not leave that in? And there were other things I think that would surprise people probably, like there's a guy out there that was one of the first remote viewers named Joe McMonagle, and he married one of Bob Monroe's daughters, and he hangs out down around the Monroe Institute now, along with another guy from that project who was not a remote viewer, but he was one of the officers that was responsible for the operations of it, Skip Atwater, who's now the head of the Monroe, he's now the president of the Monroe Institute, not the CEO, but the president, and ran their labs for many years. And Joe likes to tell the story about how he was an enlisted man for many years. He worked counterintelligence for many years in the Cold War. He's the last guy in the world who ever wanted to end his military career as a psychic spy. And he tried really, really hard to get out of it. And until his other career was basically never going to be available to him again, he refused it. And he tells the story. And so he's not a big, you know, he's a guy who would be much more comfortable doing, you know, counter operations somewhere for the intelligence community than sitting in a Senate hearing room, right? And he talks, and so he tells these, you know, stories of things that just he found profoundly frustrating from his time when he had to do that towards the end of his military career. And one of them was this great story that stuck in my head that he shared with me, and it was basically that every year he would have to go up in front of this Senate intelligence panel or House intelligence panel, I don't really remember which one it was now, and the senior person on this panel, on this committee, was just a God-fearing, Bible-thumping, right-wing Christian. And to him, the kind of stuff that Joe's project was doing just couldn't have possibly been more inspired by Satan and demons, and you know, I mean, it was just so cut and dry to the guy, right? And so it was this acrimonious event that every year in his life he had to go up and talk to them because they have to reauthorize funding and whatnot, and they would always sort of do an example. And so that finds its way into the Senator Horn character. Right? Sort of
right.
That same type of thing. So people who are immersed in different portions of the research, when they read this book, you know, they can pick people out really right and left. Or pick out composites and stuff like that. You know, there's a lot of that in there too. It's not just the research that it's in there, but we've really tried to incorporate a lot of the fun stories and a lot of the things like that that have been picked up along the way as well. If nothing else, just because I think they're great jumping off points to point people to someone like McMonagle. Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. Has really interesting things to say. He's got a great biography. So, yeah, he's famous in other parts of the world. Like, he goes on Japanese TV and does stuff. He doesn't do that here. It's kind of funny, you know, when you're around him and there's, like, a Japanese tourist nearby, they all want their picture with him, and they go crazy over him. But, the rest, you know, you can walk around America and nobody's ever heard of him. So it's the only part that isn't really true to the research publicly is the part at the very end where you start talking about magnetic and microwave energies and their ability to impact and produce non-symbolic consciousness.
Okay.
Now that is, there is work that's been done on that. And also beyond that, just generally, you know, producing thoughts with that, producing emotion with that, whatever. But that's some pretty secret research. And so, you know, you have to be, I think, a little careful. We try to be a little bit careful and a little bit respectful of that and be sort of true to that research. But you also have to sort of say, you know, this is, if this exists, this is not something that's going to be declassified, you know, tomorrow morning. So, you know, you're not going to be able to buy one of these things on the open market, you know, probably anytime soon, because there are national security issues tied up with it. And that's really where a lot of the theme from the whole book comes from, is that there are national security issues tied up with all of this. Very
right.
Competing opinions. And you meet very few people who are willing to talk about that. One of the USPA conference that I mentioned is the United States Psychotronics Association, which has to be the most interesting collection of people. And for many years, there was a lady who, not many years, but for a period of years, there was a group of people that attended there that were, you know, that had done some of the early scalar research, for instance, before the projects went to be black projects and things like that. And there's a fascinating lady named Elizabeth Rauscher who had sort of worked in this area, a very brilliant, very, very brilliant physicist. Did her PhD, I think, at Berkeley in astrophysics, and has really sort of weaved her way in and out of some of the most amazing and remarkable projects that are out there. She's still alive. Her husband was sort of an electrical engineering PhD partner of hers, died a few years ago. And she's actually working with HeartMath on their global coherence project right now. She's long since retired from the government stuff that she did. And, you know, there's a research tradition of these types of altering the brain it goes back. If you search the web a little bit, you'll find all sorts of conspiracy theories about this, and I'm not so much the conspiracy theory type, but you know, it goes back to a guy named Jose Delgado, who was doing implants in the brains of actual creatures and trying to sort of learn how to remote control them. And then you can track that through, you know, successive research projects where that became wireless, where that used different types of technologies. And I mean, there's this funny story about Elizabeth that one day she was teaching a class at Berkeley, at UC Berkeley, and she just basically mentioned, you know, that you could do this at a distance and have this effect on people's nervous systems or whatever. And her students, you know, the story goes that her students mocked her or whatever, and so she brought in a device and basically turned it on one half of the room, and their teeth started to incessantly chatter. You know, which was a nice way to do it. Better not to produce emotions, or if you wanted to prove it to people, right? You want somebody to be doing something odd that they wouldn't ordinarily be doing. So half the room, you know, starts their teeth chattering or whatever, and the other half of the room thought that the half that was chattering their teeth were Confederates, and that she was putting them on, and so she just turned the thing to the other half of the room. You know, and there's Detroit. So these technologies and these sort of remote abilities to impact the nervous system, you know, anybody who's had an interest in it, has been around a little bit, you bump into people who've played with them.
Okay. And what about Jill Bolte Taylor?
Thank you. See, this is why I had you remind me. Totally forgot about question number two. So Jill Bolte Taylor... that's a very controversial subject in the academic neuroscience community. And I think sort of what you will hear from the consensus there, I don't mean it's that there's a lot of controversy within it. I mean within them and the public, as opposed to the public. And what you're likely to hear from people that do actual brain science research, and I can't tell you how many countless people I've heard in that community discussing this, especially after her TED Talk, you know, a while back. Really, it sort of spread
right.
Like wildfire through sort of that neuroscience community, and was discussed in a lot of places, that it's really, so much of what she says is by necessity a post-construction, right? If you read her book, which you probably have, and I have, you get to the part where she's basically relearning everything, including neuroscience. Or neuroanatomy, which was her specialty. And so you know, there would have basically been a point there at which she wouldn't have had the knowledge for the descriptions that she was, you know, claiming to produce and things like that. So there's a lot of very sort of deep discussion along those types of lines. And is it really that simple? Can you really just knock out, you know, the left temporal lobe, and because the language centers are there, you know, everything suddenly poof, you're into non-symbolic consciousness. And you know, and then if you go through and you start looking at the brain scans and a little bit of neural research that has been done on this, there's really not a lot of evidence for the temporal lobe playing a lot of role in people that can take themselves in and out of non-symbolic consciousness, and so that, you know, sort of raises further questions. And so I would say that the neuroscience community is extremely skeptical of her claims. Now, not skeptical that she had the experience, certainly, but just saying this is a very complex physical system. You know, the brain is, you see someone like her on stage holding up a brain, and it's like this fixed, hard sort of piece of matter. But the brain is really sort of the consistency of porridge. It's a very, very sophisticated, complex biochemical organ. Mm-hmm. And so it's very hard for anyone who is in that world working with it every day to take something as simple as her explanation and say, okay, well, gosh, let's just, you know, turn off the language centers. That'll lead to enlightenment. There's a lot of people who have tried that. There's a lot of people who have played with that. And even if you look at Persinger and his work in Canada, and he has, you know, a couple of different helmets that are designed to run very low magnetic fields through different parts of your brain. He's a big fan of the temporal lobe, and he does like the temporal lobe, but there's a lot of critiques of his work basically saying, you know, you claim that you produce these God experiences, but where are they in your science, really? We can't find them in your science. And so there's the sort of that whole temporal lobe idea. It has its advocates, but the vast majority of people are much more focused on things like a circuit perhaps existing between the prefrontal cortex and the parietal lobes of the brain. They're just looking in other places. It seems like, you know, it might be found in other places. And so
is that a real world example of like the third rail that you're talking about in your book?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Take a guy like Persinger, for example. I mean, he's out there all alone, getting attacked all the time. He's tried to look into this stuff for his whole career, as near as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, he's a pretty isolated fella. Whereas if you look at some other people who are maybe doing brain scans of Tibetan Buddhists and stuff like that, like Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, you know, somebody like Richie Davidson is not putting out a lot of papers talking about non-symbolic consciousness. Right? He's putting out a lot of papers talking about things like depression and, you know, things that you can get grants for, things that
right.
don't ruin your career. I mean, yes, he's scanning Tibetan monks, and is he interested in non-symbolic consciousness? You better believe he's interested in non-symbolic consciousness, right? Or is he going to stand up on the dais of the American Psychological Association next year and give a keynote about him being interested? No, he's going to talk about, you know, how meditation makes people happier and how it affects certain parts of their prefrontal cortex that is shown to be associated with positive emotions, and how, you know, over the course of 3 months you can take a novice meditator and, you know, produce X, Y, or Z effect on their well-being, or take somebody who's depressed. I mean, you're going to get it couched in other things that's going to get funded that are acceptable, that you can build a career around. And you really just, you know, it's a third rail even for a guy like that. I mean, a guy with he had a very prestigious father. His father was a professor out of Stanford. He was kind of raised in he's a raised insider. You know, even he's not crazy enough to stand up and go into that. So absolutely, sure.
Okay, well, I
but
love
that's not
the book.
To say that he's not doing, he's moving the ball forward. You know, he's doing a lot of great research, and there's a lot of people out there that are doing a lot of great research. And so what I'm trying to do, what I'm hoping to do, is really sort of give those people more cover.
Yeah. Well, I love the book, and I want to know when the next one's going to be out.
Rod is working on it right now.
Okay.
He had to take a little break to do the screenplay version of this book. And then now he's on and he's writing like furiously and sending me chapters. And, yeah.
Oh, sorry about that.
No problem.
Thanks for your questions.
The draft
okay,
for
well,
that book, to answer that one, will probably be out. He'll probably have a completed draft to me sometime around the end of the year, so it'll probably be somewhere in the middle of next year.
Before we go to that question, there are a couple questions in the comments in the chat room I want to talk about before we fly by that Rob is working on the screenplay. So does that mean, because when I read The Fourth Awakening, which it was one of those grab you and take you, I said there's got to be a movie coming. So does that mean that we're going to see The Fourth Awakening?
That's a million-dollar question, right? Hollywood options a million things and makes none of them, or makes a very small handful of them. So I'm not sure. That's a very good question. Certainly we're talking to a lot of people. We've got a lot of interest in it. We're going to wait until we've got a lot more book sales under our belt before we settle on anybody and sign any contracts. But, you know, we've already had Rod has already spent his time talking to some pretty major people. We're trying to finagle it so we're in a better position to actually get it be made rather than just having it be one of those things that gets optioned stuck in a drawer.
Right. The comment in the chat room is about the loving the book. It was a fun, fast-paced read, and one of the things that he appreciated was how it touched on the aspect that if someone goes down this path and starts playing around with a different technique, there's a potential to produce negative results. And the question is, can you tell us more about how to avoid producing negative results in our lives when playing around with intention and various techniques that transform our consciousness?
Right. A good use of our last 15 minutes, probably. So, to just give a very short overview of what my thoughts are in regards to this, as I mentioned, I eventually settled on the fact that I was looking at really a sort of a continuum, a developmental continuum. Now, in psychology, there's all sorts of different developmental continuums. We develop our morality over our lifespan. We develop our intellect over our lifespan. Different emotional aspects over our lifespan, and it also is at core are the way we perceive the world. One of the interesting things about the awakenings is that when you look at the research that goes across the epochs of time for humanity, it seems to almost perfectly mirror the human life cycle in terms of the way we develop. And so if you go back to, you know, before the first awakening and then the first awakening and then the second awakening, you can really map each one of those onto a newborn, and then someone reaching a certain age and young in their, you know, early life. And there are sort of these milestones that mankind has sort of gone through, that each of us go through. I don't want to say mankind, that's a little bit, you know, gender, whatever. That happens to me sometimes when I read all these old books and then discuss them in class. I'm reading this book from like the 50s, and there's a lot of mankind in it, so that's, I'm talking about that a lot in class over the summer. So that's what's in my head right now. So there's a lot of mapping, really, where you can see, okay, well, that was a phase that every human being goes through. That was also a phase that humanity went through. And it's why we may very well be progressing towards these types of non-symbolic states being very much sort of next on the developmental continuum. So there's this continuum, and really we're all on it somewhere. So I have a fixed location that it basically represents my consciousness, just like there's on a moral scale a fixed location that represents my morality in terms of developmental level. Well, there's a developmental level for this too, and there's a certain place that I'm at that represents my personal development level as regards to sort of a contrast between everyday consciousness, what I would call symbolic consciousness, and non-symbolic consciousness, which includes all of the things that we talked about earlier. So we're all on there somewhere, and what really sort of fleshed itself out over time and over working with my research groups and trying to not just produce disasters in people's lives is that where you're at dictates what you should use technique-wise or tool-wise. So, for instance, let's say that if someone is way at the very left side of the continuum, what we talked about, sort of the new thought, and it's a lot of visualization, and it's a lot of, you know, feeling how you'll feel while that, when that comes to pass, or you're using sort of those types of extraordinarily unreliable techniques, really, for most people. Well, you know, someone that's down on that side of the fence, they're so completely mired in their symbolic consciousness. And somehow they've got to start getting through to the non-symbolic side. And I'm not saying they have to be enlightened. I'm not saying even that they have to realize that they're experiencing the non-symbolic side. But they've got to start loosening the grip of that symbolic consciousness. And so how do you do that? Well, I spent, frankly, you know, a year and a half trying to figure that out, trying to figure out what could be the doorway for people that are down on that side of the fence. And just to give you an example, one of them that is often very helpful for people who are down on that side of the continuum is a technique that came out of the University of Chicago called releasing. And releasing is a pretty simple technique. You just lay down and you, or sit, you can sit, I suppose, and you relax. And you just sort of, you progressively relax your body, and then you just sort of start paying attention to where you might have a pain or where you might have some tension in your body, and then you have very much a cognitive, thought-based dialogue with that. So you would say to it maybe something to the effect of, you know, I acknowledge you, but saying it silently to yourself, but with words, you know, I acknowledge you. And, you know, you try to get into communication with it. You try to say, you know, what is it that you have to share with me? And then you just sit quietly focused on it until things come up. And, you know, this sounds like probably a lot of the humanistic, newish types of techniques that people are familiar with. I mean, you can see hints of this in the Sedona method. You can see hints of this in EFT. You can see hints of this in all kinds of these other things that are very well known today. But this is really where it starts. Was back with some very, very rigorous research. I mean, 100 or more published papers on it. Very, very serious scientist at a very prestigious university, the University of Chicago, who really wanted to know why some of his people didn't get better and others did. And this is this technique that he is still down for that. Why, when he saw people as a clinician, did some people get better and some didn't? And how could he more reliably get people to get better? And so that's a technique that seems to really be able to produce and to help people release. So if you've got some specific thing, you know, that you're trying to work towards, that you want to get, that's, you know, you can pay attention to where those sensations come up in your body when you're focusing on it. And then you can use a technique like that to start sort of peeling the layers of the onion. So we all have a place on the continuum. Most people are way on that left side. People that have been in the spiritual practices or really been on a personal quest or whatever for many years or really worked to develop themselves in other ways, they'll find themselves at other places on the continuum. And if you were to take a technique from another place on that continuum and try to get the person that's all the way on that left side of it to use it, that's when you wind up with those disastrous consequences. But if you can, so what I'm trying to figure out is where do things best match up, and then where do people best match up so that they can use the technique that is going to produce results for them. And, you know, if something's not working, I mean, here's a really good piece of advice: stop doing it. You know, if you think that, if you've been like visualizing whatever it is that you want to have happen and it hasn't happened, stop visualizing it, frankly. I mean, you know, yes, there are the stories of people that visualize it forever and ever and ever and ever, and eventually it comes true. Well, yeah, there's normative release that can happen. You can wait that out if you want. But chances are there's another method that you can find if you're just willing to look around a little bit. And so, you know, if you're practicing a method and you notice, geez, you know, things are worse today than they were yesterday, obviously that's one to pitch. And it was a lot of that iterative process in mapping things to the model and mapping things to the continuum, figuring out who, what type of person fits each one. It's been a little crazy to try to figure a lot of that out. But you can do it. You can play with it a little bit on your own until that work gets out there, until I get around to writing that up and get around to sort of releasing that type of thing. I would say one other thing, and that is I learned when I really thought I had it all figured out, I had somebody stump me, and that is he was having really good results with where I'd put him on the model, and he tried a couple of the techniques there, and there's usually I usually say there's like three techniques, you know, just try, pick one. If that one doesn't work, try one of the others. If that one doesn't work, try the other one. And probably one of those three are going to work for you. Now, he was having great results with one of those. And there was something that was just disastrous that was going on with a very close member of his family. And he, no matter how much he did that technique, he could not produce results in that situation with that member of his family. It was one of his children, basically. And, you know, that one kind of stumped me, I've got to say. It stumped me for a little while. And what came out of that was a whole other layer of the research that I then worked on for the next year, which basically was that some things in us are so deep that although we have a general place on the continuum, there are things that touch it that seem to, I don't know, you know, this is the only way that I can conceptualize it really. There are things that seem to touch into us in other ways that are such deep places in us that it's almost like it's a different version of us, a different developmental version of us that is dealing with that part. And certainly you could see that it would be kids, right? I mean, if you're a parent and you're having a difficult situation with a kid, you could see how that might not be your normal state of consciousness. You know, you might not be dealing with that internally in the same way that you would deal with everything else in your life. So there seem to be things that are very deep. And so once I reasoned that out a little bit, and once I started really sort of put that together, I said, hey, you know what, you should, you know, let's think about where that version of you might be, and I think it's probably here, so why don't you try this? And he called me an hour later basically saying, you know, that's totally better, totally good. So I'll just plant that thought that while we have a place sort of on this continuum that is sort of general and takes care of most things and seems to be where we operate from most of the time for whatever this development level measures within us, there are deep parts of us that can go into other things that we might have to use a different technique from a very different place on the continuum for it to resolve. Not the most frequent thing, not a very frequent thing that I've seen, but I've seen it from time to time.
Are you still there, Jeffrey?
I am.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we just had a power something, so I lost my computer.
Oh,
so glad you're still here. Yeah, and my phone was charging, so I... because, of course, you were explaining so well, and people were really curious about that I'd added another half an hour so you didn't feel pressured to end, so you can take a breath. And we can actually have a conclusion rather than feeling like we have to get cut off. I just will apologize to anyone who is going to take us a minute or two to get back into the system. In the meantime, though, again, Jeffrey, I sincerely want to thank you for taking the time, especially during this busy summer course, to spend answering questions and sharing your research and insights, because it is very, very powerful. And we do want to touch base with a couple things yet before we close out our interview, so thanks for that extra time. And so if we were to, was there anything else you wanted to add about the things that people could do to basically protect themselves if they want to do work with, you know, the law of attraction or working with intention and to avoid the disastrous and negative results that could happen?
Really, they just need to pay it. I mean, until I have time to actually publish this or talk about it more or whatever, the best that people can do is to ask themselves, since I started using this technique, have I seen a benefit? Because the benefit should be rapid. There are long-term versions of it, sure, just like there are long-term versions of it in terms of how to get to non-symbolic consciousness. But, you know, the results really should be like that hour later example. That, you know, you should notice the results. If you're not noticing the results, you're probably out of sync, and if you're out of sync, you're asking for it.
And then that is a great flag, just knowing that. And,
absolutely.
Yes. And if people wanted to learn more and wanted to follow your research, what's the best way for them to do that?
Probably just to create an account on the Fourth Awakening website, a user account. There's a little username and password thing, and you can, you know, create an account and log in there. which people do to get the PDF of the book.
We haven't talked about that. Do you want to talk about that?
Website, sure.
And join the website. And
it's fourthawakening.com. Fourth is spelled out, FourthAwakening.com. And if you, right now, and I don't know how long we're going to leave this up. We're intending to leave it up for quite a while. But if you, when you go to the main page, there's a little box where you can sign up for a user account. And if you then log in, there is a link to download the book, a PDF of the book, from the user menu. It sort of appears, this little mystery link, little tiny link appears on the user menu, and you can download a full copy of the book from there. Most people don't like to read it on the screen. You know, we get a lot of emails from people who, like, I started reading it on the screen, but I had to order from, you know, Amazon, or I had to go to the bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally understand that. The whole thing is available. If people can, you know, stand reading it on their screen, they're more than welcome to. And, of course, pass
mm-hmm.
it along.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I would say, you know, because that I can email people and send them updates and stuff, that's probably where I'll be doing it from, or the people who have signed up on that website. That's probably where I'll be sending that type of information. There's another academic site for my center. It's centerforintent.org, but it really doesn't have a lot for the public.
Okay. All right. And for people who are on Facebook, how can they get the word out about the book on Facebook?
Oh, of course. We love that. Huh? We love the social media stuff and the way things spread
Absolutely.
Like wildfire. And here I am sitting at Harvard, the home of Facebook, where it all came from. So, sure, we want to use that. There's a Fourth Awakening page. There's a Fourth Awakening fan page that people can go to, and you can just search for the Fourth Awakening when you're in Facebook, and you can become a fan of it. Rod and I have separate fan pages as well. And Facebook has a mechanism, of course, where you can suggest to other people that they become a fan. What I found with that is that it's not as helpful to suggest that other people become a fan as it is to just go through and send a private message out to people. People probably that are on Facebook a lot get a lot of requests to become a fan of this or that, and they just kind of ignore them. So while we've got, and we're doing really good in terms of our fans and stuff on Facebook, and that's, we're so appreciative for everyone who's willing, because this is really a mission for us. You know, this is, and especially for me, as you can hear, I mean, this is a mission.
Mm-hmm. And there is such passion in your voice when you talk about this.
Right.
And
you know,
it's obvious that it's a mission for you.
I don't want all these people to be out there having these train wrecks in their lives because they're believing material from the late 1800s that's been rehashed, you know, in modern times
mm-hmm.
and didn't work back then and is spotty. And it's, you know, it's kind of a horrifying thing to know that that's going on. And also you have the whole non-symbolic piece, and you've got, you know, all of that. And, if, you know, that whole awareness that of really just, what a difference it makes in your life to realize that you're part of this progression of human consciousness and that you're where you're at in that. And, you know, how much more happy and fulfilling and whatnot your life can be and how to really sort of head towards that. And that's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of what I wrestle with in terms of how to get that information out there, in terms of there's a split there, right? Because tomorrow all of us aren't going to be enlightened. And so I can't just be putting information out there about the road to enlightenment. I've also got to make sure that I have the information out there that there's a huge positive psychology movement going on right now with a lot of empirical research, a lot of scientific research into what does and doesn't make people happy. And so, you know, I want to make sure that as much of that is in there as well, because ordinarily when you go to a bookstore, for instance, and you buy a book about gratitude, you know, it'll say, well, you should, you know, journal out everything that you can, analyze everything that you're grateful for. Well, you know, it turns out if you look at the actual scientific evidence, that makes you less happy. That if you look at the gratitude research, if you analyze a negative experience from your past, a negative memory from your past, it takes away its power and can make you happier. If you ruminate on a negative experience, meaning just relive it over and over in your head, replay it over and over in your head, it makes you less happy. Flip over to that. If you ruminate on a positive experience, it makes you happy. If you analyze a positive experience, it takes the power out of the positive experience, just like analyzing takes it out of the negative experience, and it makes you less happy. So if you're out there journaling and analyzing the, you know, your positive thoughts and detailing all these little nitty-gritty reasons why you're grateful for this, that, or the other thing, you know, lots of times what you're doing there, the scientific evidence shows that you're basically pulling, you're removing happiness with that. And so there's all the self-help books, and none of them are based in the scientific research. Very, very few of them are based in the scientific research. You have some that are out there that have been published by academics, but these people are overworked. You know, you've got students, you've got all kinds of research, you're writing grants, you don't have time to publicize a book. And then you've got everybody else who's not looking at the scientific literature, who's just kind of throwing darts at a wall for what feels good and what they think will make people happy. And those people have all the time in the world to go on shows and promote their stuff and whatever, right? And so their stuff flies off the shelf, and the actual research-driven ones that don't make people go in the opposite direction sit on the shelves and don't go anywhere because there's nobody out there promoting them. So it's interesting catch-22s. So I'm trying to, you know, I've got to make sure that the material that is put out increases what we call in the scientific and in the psychology community well-being, and that's just sort of happiness, and happiness is folded in there. But it increases people's well-being and their symbolic consciousness, as well as pointing in the direction of that, you know, so much greater fulfillment and happiness that's possible with non-symbolic experiences, when non-symbolic experiences enter your life, even when they enter your life sporadically. It doesn't, you know, not even just in a permanent way. So
right.
Rolling all
of
that together, that's a lot of work.
That is a lot of work. And so for people who were listening to you tonight or people who have joined the community at the Fourth Awakening, because you mentioned earlier about, excuse me, the footnotes that are not there in the book for people who want to know what's fiction and what's research-based,
right,
to be able to know when that is going to be available.
Right, exactly. That's what I'll do. I'll announce stuff like that as I have time to create it on the fourthawakening.com's sign-up list, basically.
Okay. Amazing.
And I'll probably post some of it there, too, I'm sure. I have a section waiting for it. It's all ready, you know?
Exactly. If we just had some more hours in a day, that's the other thing. And Jeffrey, again, it has been such a pleasure having you here and learning about your research and the journey to create the Fourth Awakening. And as you just shared, it is a mission for you to get accurate information to people. And so if you're listening to this segment and you want to know more, fourthawakening.com is a great place to go and to connect with people in that community and to let people know about this amazing story. That really is a good read. So if they just want a good story, they'll also get some good information as well. So, again, Jeffrey, thank you so much for being with us. And that was my last question, which I think you addressed, was what key message or concept do you want listeners to take away from this interview? And I'll let you say it again just so that people, that's the last thing that they hear.
Oh, well, let me just take this and redirect it a little and just thank you very much for your time and thank you for your wonderful show and for taking time out of your busy life. I know you have a very busy life and you make time to do this show and put this out there for people, and that's just, you know, such a wonderful service.
Well, you are most welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me on. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about all of this, and I'm so grateful for what you're out there doing as well.
Thank you. And for those of you listening, the segments are archived. They're downloadable in MP3s. You can put links on websites to the show. So please share that to let people know how to access the information that you heard tonight and that you benefited from, and to support Jeffrey in his mission to get good information, research-based information, to people who do want to continue to learn and grow in their lives and be a part of a positive change and a positive trend, not only in their lives, but in the communities and on the planet. So with that, I thank those of you who waited patiently on the phone, those of you who chatted in the chat room. And Jeffrey, I hope that we have an opportunity to do a show again in the future.
Sounds wonderful.
Please give me a call if you've got a topic you'd like to share. I'm happy to have you back. And for those listening, take an action on something that you heard tonight. Grab a book, go to a website, share the information, because when you take action is when you can truly spark the change that you want in your life. I hope you come back and join us again for future guests and future sparks. Until then, I hope you choose to create a great day as you continue to make a positive difference in the lives you touch. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Spark Radio with Ms. Melanie. Please share this show link with those you believe would enjoy and benefit from listening. We invite you to join us for upcoming shows with special guests and more sparks. May a spark you heard ignite a positive change in your life. Good day.